Are you ready for the book of Judges? Well, let's turn there then, shall we? Just in case there are newcomers or you're wondering, why do we study the Old Testament and not only the New Testament? I have a very good answer for you from the New Testament, actually. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians in the 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians, he speaks about the history of the children of Israel. And in speaking about their successes and their failures, he said in the 10th chapter, around the 11th verse, "These things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age have come." We can learn from examples, good ones and bad ones, and the Bible is full of both. For our admonition, for our instruction, the Old Testament was written. And so our method of study has been, since we started this fellowship actually, to cover all of the Bible. And it used to be Sunday nights, and now it's Wednesday nights. And our method has been to take an Old Testament book and then bounce to a New Testament book, then go old and new so we can kind of get a balance of flow. And so in the Old Testament, we have gone through the book up to the book of Joshua. Now we're back at Judges, but we did Romans before. So after Judges, we'll go to Corinthians. After 1 Corinthians, we'll go back to Ruth. After Ruth, we'll hit 2 Corinthians, etc. So it kind of gives us a balance of both. It also is partially because I'm a little schizophrenic and I kind of don't know, you know, it's hard to stick with one thing for a long period of time. So, you know, we did pretty good 36 weeks in Romans, so it's time for the Old Testament now. That's how I look at it. I hope you're not taking bets on how far we'll cover tonight. Because, you know, you just never know, do you? But notice verse 1. Let's just jump right in and notice how it begins. "Now after the death of Joshua." Stop there. That's when all the trouble began. After the death of Joshua. Joshua is no longer around as we open this book. He has died, though we will recap his death in the second chapter of the book of Judges. This phrase introduces a new period in the history of the children of Israel, the Jewish people. There is a void of leadership. Joshua was a tremendous leader. He got, of course, his calling through the Lord from Moses. Moses raised him up to take over for him, but now he is dead. And in this leadership vacuum, in this void, all sorts of problems will occur. Now, there will be victories in this void, but all sorts of problems we will read about in this book that opens up after the death of Joshua. The more I read the book of Joshua, the more I am made aware of how parallel the history of Israel is with, I think, the history of the United States of America. And I'll show you here in the next few moments, I hope. And I think through the book you will see how striking their history is with, I think, our history and the way we started as a nation and where we are today, so that now you have generations of people that, A, don't even know American history, and, B, don't know how much God played a part of it. They're just unaware of it. In fact, you tell them, oh, come on, just so ignorant of it. That's what happens in the book of Judges with the children of Israel. The British historian Arnold Toynbee once noted that out of the 22 civilizations on the stage of world history, 19 of them collapsed when they reached the moral position of the United States of America. 19 of them collapsed. That's why Judges is so relevant. Because in the book of Judges, you have the nation of Israel that is basically a permissive society without any moral underpinnings left. They once had them, but they don't have them anymore. They deteriorate very, very quickly. And you have, by the time of Judges, as it kind of unfolds to the very end, classic existentialism. Everybody does what is right in his own eyes. In fact, that's one of the key verses. Listen to this quote from Dr. Stephen Muller, president of Johns Hopkins University. Quote, Failure to rally around a set of values means that we are turning out highly skilled barbarians. Society as a whole is turning out barbarians because of the discarding of the value system it was built upon. To restore its lost value system, America would have to return to faith in its God. There can be no value system where there is no supreme value that transcends man's natural self-centeredness, where one man's values are esteemed as good as another. That's America, and that is Israel during the time of the book of Judges. Now, a warning. This is one of the saddest books in the Bible, because it's the story of one nation under God that turns from the God that it was once under. And it's sort of like you're watching the death. It's the patient in the hospital, the last throes of life. And spasms as the patient contorts, losing its life, going on into death. Think of their history for a moment. Refresh your memory with what they have seen. Let's see, they've been delivered from Egypt. An incredible, miraculous thing that happened. Red Sea opening. Then they were preserved for 40 years in the middle of the desert. Miraculously, of course, bread from heaven, water from a rock. God leading them through that terrible time, even though they complained and they went against God. Then God brings them to the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey, their inheritance, a place for them to come and to rest. After the deliverance in Egypt, after the wilderness wandering, after crossing the Jordan, they're now in the land. Now they sort of got it made in the shade, and they sort of settle down. They sort of are done with the hard parts of life. They don't want to deal with stuff anymore. They want to just enjoy life. And every successive generation you will find in this book, every new generation forgets what the last generation went through. I think this is typical of not just Jewish history. I think this is typical of history in general. The battles that our fathers fought, and my father was in World War II, we tend to very much forget about them in our generation. Or the Vietnam War, etc., and the battles that Israel saw, and then the miraculous deliverance that God gave them, is forgotten by succeeding generations after them. Now, there is a key verse. I want to draw your attention to it. And all you have to do is go to the very last verse of the book of Judges, and you'll find the key verse. It's repeated several times in the book, but it's easiest to find if you turn to the very last verse. Chapter 21, verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It's a key verse. That is the summation of the entire story of Judges. That doesn't mean we can close here and move on to the next book. We want to find out why, don't we? We want to find out the highlights of it, don't we? We want to see how God intervened in all this. There was no king in Israel. A leadership vacuum, a void. 350 years from the military prowess of General Joshua, who's now dead, to the first king of Israel. Those 350 years of incredible declension morally, spiritually, militarily. Until there is a king in Israel, everyone does what is right in his own eyes. You have here classic existentialism, which means there is no standard of right and wrong, no ultimate underpinning of a value system, no ultimate standard of morality. It's what happens when personal rights become an idol in a society, which they have become in our society. The big thing is what's right for me may not be right for you. I have my personal rights. And when personal rights take precedence over the good of the society and the will of God, you have such a deterioration that all that is left is existentialism. Because nature abhors a vacuum. You take away a leader in touch with God, push God and his value system out of your life, you have to create your own, which is your own personal rights, your own personal view of life. Apart from any value system, you have pure, whatever works for you is cool. And that's what you have in the nation of Israel. This is what's ironic. What I hope you grasp in this book is the irony that the more freedom they seem to have, the more in bondage they become. The more personal freedom they have, the more in bondage they become. There's an old adage that says, the more you do as you please, the less you will be pleased with what you do. There is sort of a bondage in just becoming your own God. Life is very unpalatable after a period of time in that, with no restraint, with no submission to God. I say that the age of the book of Judges parallels the age of America presently, not only by some of the examples I just mentioned, but there's so much literature written about what we believe in these days. One book that I've referred to often is a book by James Patterson and Peter Kim called The Day America Told the Truth. It's a book of what we believe. Great studies were taken and polls were compiled, and our value system was published in this book. This is what they said. Americans are making up their own rules, their own laws. Only 13% of us believe in all of the Ten Commandments. 40% of us believe in five of the Ten Commandments. Point is, we choose the laws of God we want to believe in. There is absolutely no moral consensus in this country. We are just a law unto ourselves. Hello? Now the problem with this, you'll see with the children of Israel, is though they go farther away from God, they rationalize it. They justify it. Well, listen, it's right, it's okay, because they're masters at rationalizing. They always have been. And that's why it's such a good mirror for us. Very apropos. Now, this shouldn't take you by surprise, because we know something from the Scripture, don't we? That there's something innate in man that tends toward rebellion. It's called the sin nature. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. We've all gone to our own way. We've done our own thing, do what's right in our own eyes. That's part of human nature, in rebellion against God. We saw it with the children of Israel. They are delivered from the bondage of Egypt. They get out in the desert, and now they've just seen a body of water open up, and the wet ground turned dry. They've just seen God miraculously providing water out of a rock and bread out of heaven, etc., etc. You know the story. And so what do? Do they say, oh, praise God, hallelujah, every day? They gripe, they complain, they murmur. Even after seeing what they have seen, so soon do they revert to that activity, forgetting the good hand of God. So there's that part of human nature that just has a bent in that direction. Rebellion, complaining. And they wandered for 40 years, faithless, until they get to Canaan. Now, as soon as they cross the Jordan River and they get into this land of milk and honey, the brand new land of Canaan, they face Jericho, and for the first time in many years, their faith is exercised. In the Battle of Jericho, they trust God, the walls come tumbling down, you know the story. And so they start distributing the land. Now, in the book of Joshua, they entered the land. And in the book of Joshua, they distributed the land, right, to the 12 tribes of Israel. One thing they did not fully do when they crossed the Jordan River is occupy the land. There was not a complete conquest that was still going on by the time of Joshua's death. And now the chapter opens up and says, now after the death of Joshua. Go back to Joshua 24 for just a moment. Good to get a little context. I know I haven't even finished one verse, but we got to introduce the book. Joshua 24, beginning in verse 14, we'll pick it up. This is Joshua's last act, renewing the covenant with the people before his death. Now therefore, verse 14, chapter 24 of Joshua, now therefore fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And so the people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord and serve other gods. Okay? Remember that. That's their pledge. No, man, we're going to follow God. What you said, buddy, what you said, that's what we're going to do. Now, we get to the next book, the book of Judges. They made a promise, but instead of victory comes defeat. Instead of freedom comes oppression. And there is a moral decline as well. So after the death of Joshua marks the end of strong, central, spiritual leadership, there is a vacuum that has to be filled, and it will be filled individually. Why is the book called the Book of Judges? Because there are in this book 13 leaders, 12 men, one woman, who become the judges, not in the judicial sense that we think of it today in the modern jurisprudence system. But the word judge in Hebrew is the word judges, shofetim. Shofetim are rulers or deliverers. We could even translate it literally, saviors. They will deliver the children of Israel when they get into tight spots because of the enemies that are around them in the settling of the land. I want you to turn now to chapter 2. You say, well, we haven't finished chapter 1 yet. I know we haven't. But turn to chapter 2 anyway. Because the book of Judges follows a cycle. And if we understand it now, the rest of the book will make sense. It's called the sin cycle of the nation of Israel. And there's four parts to this cycle. And they just sort of keep following cyclically this pattern through the book of Judges. This is sort of, again, a summation, but you're seeing it in parts now of how this book unfolds. First of all, there's rebellion. They get tired of following God only. They get a little bit restless spiritually. And so they rebel against God. They start looking at other gods and goddesses and other worship systems and other ways of belief. So they rebel against God. Second phase of the cycle is retribution. Retribution. In essence, God says, okay, you don't want to serve me, you don't have to. You want to worship the other gods, tell you what, I'll let that people group that has those gods take you as slaves and you'll serve them and you can worship their gods all day long. How's that? In the second phase of the sin cycle, they get pretty tired of that. They see where that's headed. And the third phase is repentance. They cry out to God and say, hey, uncle, we blew it. Receive us back. And the fourth phase is restoration. God receives them back, brings them back as the covenant people. And so those are four phases of the sin cycle. Now, they're there, but they're not there very long. They're restored, but then a new generation comes along. New kids on the block, forget about dad and mom and all the problems and stuff they learned, so they repeat the sin cycle. I said it was a sad book. But look at chapter 2, verse 10, how the cycle works. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they forsook the God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. And so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them. And they were greatly distressed. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up shofetim, judges, deliverers, who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord, so they did not do. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. You see, the repentance and then the restoration. And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. And so there you have the cycle of the book. And you'll see that repeated in so many stories with people that you already know about, like Samson and like Deborah and like Gideon. These are the judges, the deliverers, during this sin cycle. Now back to verse 1. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand." So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, "Come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory." And Simeon went with him. Now we're introduced to a group known as the Canaanites. Who were they? Well, the Canaanites is a broad generic term, like saying Americans. Who are Americans? Boy, there's a lot of different backgrounds, ethnic groups, histories that form America. The Canaanites were simply those who dwelt in the land of Canaan, principally between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. Up and down from the top of Tyre and Sidon, Phoenicia, all the way down toward Egypt. That is the land of Canaan, the promised land. Part of the Canaanites were Hittites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Perizzites, Termites. No, I'm just kidding. But all of these individual groups, because the way politics worked back then is that rather than nations like we have today, though land will get taken over by great empires later on, there were city-states. And so you'll have the king of Jerusalem or the king of Jericho. It's simply a tiny little settlement by today's standards with a wall around it. It's a little city in the middle of nowhere, and that king is like the mayor. He's the king of that town, king of the hill. And there are several of these city-states scattered throughout Canaan, and all of these people groups are the Canaanites. Now, something else to notice. They ask who will go up first. God says Judah. The children of Israel at this point in their history are still known according to their ancient tribal names, the 12 people groups that descended from the line of Jacob. These are sons of Jacob. Jacob's name is changed later to Israel. So literally, the sons of Israel and their progeny, they revert back to their tribal names, or they're called by their tribal names still at this point in their history. They're settling in different parts of the land, right? One tribe here, one tribe there, some east, some west of the Jordan River. Judah is selected to go fight first. Joshua's dead. At first, good signs. The book opens up with it. Great, they're praying. They're talking to God. God, what should we do? And God responds, send Judah. Now, this isn't going to last very long. It's just sort of the introductory chapter, but it goes south quickly. At first, they're seeking the Lord, and God first says, send Judah. Why Judah? Judah isn't the first son of Jacob. He's the fourth on the list, yet he's the first to go here. He's the first to march, even before this and after this, and they're the first always to go into battle. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I have a hunch is because it's the kingly tribe. It's the lion tribe. Jacob, before his death, prophesied about each of his sons' future endeavors and what they would accomplish. In Genesis 49, he says, "Judah, you are he whom your fathers shall praise." That's what Judah means, praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. So the rest of the children of Israel would be giving him preeminence. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down. He lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? So this tribe, from which, by the way, Jesus Christ will come, is first to go up to battle. Now, Jacob didn't stop with that part of the prophecy. He said something else. The first part of the prophecy seems to indicate why Judah was chosen as the first to march, the first to go into battle, and the first to go up here after Joshua's death. But back in Genesis 49, Jacob continued his prophecy and said this, "The scepter, the rulership, shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes, nor shall a lawgiver depart from between his feet until Shiloh comes," or the Shiloh is the word that means the one to whom it belongs. And the rabbis from that time on, or the Jewish leaders and on into the rabbis, started believing, even before Jesus came, the Messiah would be born from the tribe of Judah, and that one of the signs of his coming, that Messiah would arrive, is when the scepter departs from Judah. Judah's the southern kingdom. The capital of it becomes Jerusalem. So they were looking for some sign that would indicate the scepter of rulership in Judah would be taken away, and when it's taken away, their Messiah is going to come. When the Romans occupy the land of Israel years later during New Testament times, the Romans come in, set up shop, become the boss, the kingpin on the block, go into Jerusalem, and they do an interesting thing. They set up a new rule, and they demand that the right of capital punishment that was executed by the tribe of Judah be taken away. They no longer have judicial rights in the area of capital punishment, even for their own religious system. The rabbis, the scribes, the Pharisees, when they found that out, that that right of capital punishment was taken away from them, they started lamenting, Josephus says, in a parade around Jerusalem. Put sackcloth and ashes on their heads, and they shouted, "The scepter has departed from Judah, but Shiloh has not come." They were lamenting that God broke his promise to the nation. The scepter has departed, but there is no Messiah. During their parade, they had no idea that just a few miles north in the town of Nazareth was about a 13-year-old young man working in a carpenter shop, getting ready soon to lay down his tools and come into the very city of Jerusalem, and would one day toward the end of his career be hailed as their Messiah, whom they did not receive. They just bewailed the fact that God has broken his promise, but he did not. The scepter departed, Shiloh had come. That was just sort of a preview of coming attractions. Here we see this priestly tribe chosen by God to even fight the first battle as the book opens. Then Judah went up. Verse 4, "And the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites," all part of the Canaanite group, "into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek." When Joshua was alive, he was the general, right? He was the guy in charge, and all the tribes answered to him. There was a unity among all the tribes of Israel when Joshua was alive. You're going to see that split up now. It'll become very territorial. And there will be a skirmish in the Philistine country where Dan is, the tribe of Dan. Or there'll be a skirmish up north, the Phoenician peoples up in the area of Naphtali. And in those various regions, God will raise up a judge, a leader, a deliverer, to deliver that section of the land out. No more is the land working cooperatively together. It's haphazard. It's broken up. There's no unity. There's no cohesion. And they found, verse 5, Adonai Bezek in Bezek. It's a good place to find a guy with that name. Of course, Adonai just simply means the Lord of Bezek. So he's the king, he's the guy in charge of Bezek. They found him in Bezek, where he's reigning. And fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adoni-Bezek fled. They pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. And Adoni-Bezek said, well, he probably said ouch first, but when he was recovered, he probably said sometime later, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. And he brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. It's an interesting kind of a way to open up the book of Judges. Now, obviously, here's a guy who was a king who took over territory, and he's boasting of one time he took 70 kings and did this to them. This is payback for all 70. Unfortunately, the children of Israel are already showing signs of paganism. This is a pagan practice. And so they're kind of emulating the ways of other nations. Now, this is a trend that will continue until finally they say, we want a king like other nations. And Saul will be chosen. Why cut off the thumbs and the big toes? Because you lose dexterity without your thumb. You can't handle a sword properly without the thumb. So you're defenseless. You can't run well, so you lose your footing. You're not steady on your feet anymore. So it effect ends one's military career. To get your thumb and toes cut off, that's military life. And so it's ended. Now, it does illustrate what happens when people surrender to our enemy, the devil. I think there's a lesson to be learned. Just like here, these guys couldn't walk or run correctly. When we yield territory back to the devil, we're captivated by some sin. It hinders our walk, doesn't it? We're spiritually impeded. We don't make progress in the spirit. Our walk is destroyed. Also, they couldn't use their sword effectively, and so it is with Christians. We become estranged from the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. We can't use the Bible effectively anymore. We read it. It convicts us, and it doesn't speak to us anymore, and we put it away. We're not using our sword like we ought to. So there is a parallel. Verse 8, now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. And they struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. Now Jerusalem will one day become their capital. It's given the name Jerusalem here, but it's still called, even though it's mentioned as Jerusalem here, it is still called, during this time, Jebus, because the Jebusites occupy that area. Now, it says they took the city. Doesn't mean they, in fact, they didn't settle in it at all. They won't settle in it until 1,000 years B.C., several years later, when David will take over the Jebusite city. Remember, Joab climbs up the water shaft? And he becomes the captain of David's troops because he is first to help conquer the city. So all they do here is burn it. And it's ours, but nobody lives in it. They just burn it, and it's kind of a ghost town for a period of years. It'll be resettled by the Jebusites, and then David will take it later. Verse 9, and afterwards, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains in the south and in the lowland. It's a summary statement, verse 9. A summary verse of the southern battles, if you will, in the southern part of the region. And there's three areas that are mentioned, that are three of the geographical areas of the Holy Land, the mountains. How many of you have ever been to Israel? Raise your hands. Okay. How many of you would like to go to Israel? Raise your hands. Okay, I know that. I'm sorry. I'm trying to taunt you a little bit. Shame on me. Jerusalem, Bethlehem, all the way up to where the mountains drop off into the valley of Esdraelon, that central spine is that one highest area. It's the mountain range of Israel. Then if you go south, geographically, from about Hebron down all the way to Kadesh Barnea, it's all desert. That's the Negev desert. And then the lowland is what we call the Shephelah. It's the coastal plain from the Mediterranean. It rises up toward the mountain spine. And the lowland is the beautiful Shephelah where crops are grown and many cities were developed there because it's you get the beach breezes. It's just a great place. And consequently, that's where the battles are fought. And so this is where the concentration goes in these areas in that verse. Then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, or Kiriath Arba, the village of the four, that's what it means in Hebrew, and they killed Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmi. Hebron is one of the principal cities for the Jewish people. David will reign 7 years in Hebron. He becomes the king of that city-state, and that is his first part of his reign before he becomes king in Jerusalem and over the whole nation. This is where Abraham came and pitched his tent. Remember back in Genesis it says that Abraham came and pitched his tent by the terebinth trees at Mamre, which is at Hebron. This is where he came first into the land and settled in this area, so it becomes very significant to the children of Israel later on. They take it. How do they take it? By a guy by the name of Caleb, who's a little over 85 years of age. In fact, look down at verse 20. They gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. And then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. We'll get more to that as we go on. But verse 11. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer, village of the chair. Caleb said, "Whoever attacks Kiriath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Achshah as wife." And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. And so he gave him his daughter, Achshah's wife. Debir is the next logical place to go because Jerusalem, you go down south to Hebron, you go 11 miles southwest of Hebron, and you get to the city of Debir, and they took it. Now notice Othniel is mentioned in verse 13. Keep him in your mind because you'll see him again in the next few chapters. By chapter 4, he's the first judge. He's the first deliverer. When the Mesopotamians harass the children of Israel and they cry out to God, Othniel will become the leader who delivers the children of Israel. Notice who he is. He's related to Caleb. He's Caleb's nephew, about to become Caleb's son-in-law. Interesting that he's related to Caleb. It makes me think that faith somehow runs in the family. Caleb, such a strong leader, one of the two witnesses along with Joshua who spied out the land. He's an old guy right now. And he goes, "Hey, I want to take this land. I need help. Whoever helps me, my daughter's up for bid. You can have her as wife." I don't know what she thought about that, but that's just how things worked back then. But he was the nephew of Caleb. I want to say something about that. You have, where you are, a chance, an opportunity to influence people. You may not be a king, you may not be a mighty general, or you might not have command of great numbers of people, but just the fact that you have family members and can influence them, you're in a position much like Caleb, who obviously influenced Othniel. Othniel becomes not only a mighty warrior, but the first judge of Israel, the deliverer. Godly relatives, the example of God-fearing relatives, do more to educate people, especially children, than all of the Sunday school classes, Christian schools, and anything else put together. That influence of somebody godly. In fact, a study showed that if both mother and father attend church regularly, this is just parents now, there's a 72% chance that their children will remain faithful spiritually. If the dad only does it, not the mom, there's a 55% chance the child will remain faithful. And if only mother remains faithful and continually goes to church, etc., but not the dad, 15%. However, many people have testified to the godly example of an aunt or an uncle, somebody in the family who is just serving God faithfully. So wherever you're at, do that as a token of love and example to those in your family. Verse 14, now it happened when she came to him, this is Caleb's daughter now, that she urged him to ask her father for a field. She dismounted from her donkey and Caleb said to her, "What do you wish?" And so she said, "Give me a blessing. Since you've given me the land in the south, give me also springs of water And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Not only does faith run in Caleb's family, but boldness does as well, doesn't it? Remember, Caleb was the guy who walked forward, and when Joshua was distributing the land and says, "Now, wait a minute. I want Hebron. Moses promised. I want it now." He was bold. By the way, Caleb means bold. His daughter was bold. And why not? Dad just gave her the Negev desert. "Hey, if you're giving me the desert, Dad, I want water rights. So give me, as my dowry, I want the springs of water." He goes, "Fair enough. Take the upper springs and the lower springs." So she had all the water rights to go with it. Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms. That's another term for Jericho, which was taken in the first battle in Joshua, with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south near Arad, way, way down there. And they went and dwelt among the people. The Kenites are ancient people, group. They first mentioned in Genesis 15 as descendants of Abraham. They were semi-nomadic desert dwellers. They had a knowledge of the one true God. The brother-in-law of Moses, Hobab was his name, Hobab, became the chief of the Kenites after Jethro passed on, and he perpetuated this godly tribe that became allies to the children of Israel. City of Palms, as I mentioned, is Jericho. Joshua cursed the city, so they're looking for a new place to hang out. And Judah, verse 17, went with his brother Simeon, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it, so the name of the city was called Hormah. Isn't there a meat product called Hormah? Like ham or something like that? Hormel, okay, sorry. And Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, Ekron with its territory. This is all Philistine country. You may want to just remember that, because the Philistines will hassle these guys big time in this book. So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers. But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. I always have loved studying Caleb. And now that he's mentioned again, it takes us back. Do you remember the book of Joshua? 14th chapter and the 15th chapter, Joshua is distributing the land. He comes forward and says, "Moses promised me Hebron. I want it." And look at him now. He's in his upper 80s. And it says, then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. This guy's still a fighter. Over 80 years before this event, way back around Numbers chapter 13, Moses decides to send 12 secret agents into the land on a six-week tour of the Holy Land. They go and spy it out. Joshua and Caleb go to a place near Hebron called Eshcol, and they take these huge bundle of grapes on their back and bring it up as a token of, this land is awesome, flowing with milk and honey. Look at it. Here's the fruit of the land. It's so big. They were the minority, you remember, in Numbers 13. 10 of these secret agents come back and go, there's some big dudes in that land. They're giants. We've never seen people that tall and strong and mighty. And they have walled cities. Forget going into the land. Just stay here. Joshua and Caleb said, oh, they're big. Just means they're easier to hit. They're easier targets. I say, the Lord is with us, and we go in and take it. Now, what's interesting is, here you have 12 guys all seeing exactly the same thing, right? It's exactly the same sites, the same land, the same people, the same villages. 10 of them saw big giants and a small god. 2 of them saw a huge god and big guys, but overgrown midgets, really, in comparison to God. 10 of them measured the giants by their own strength. Two of them measure them by God's strength. What's your perspective when you look at life? You know, I know people, every day it's giant, it's huge. Every week, oh, this is tough. There's other people who say, you know what, God's in it, who cares, let's just go. Now, he never lost that. He's in his upper 80s, man. And he says, hey, there's some giants. I miss fighting giants. Let me read the narrative. You don't have to turn to it. This is Joshua 14. As he steps forward and talks to Joshua, Caleb says, now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel wandered in the wilderness. And now, here I am, this day, 85 years old. As yet, I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war, both for going out and for coming in. Now, therefore, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the giants, the Anakim, were there, that the cities were great and fortified. Listen to this. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall be able to drive them out as the Lord said. Don't you love his guts? Maybe I'll win. I mean, now maybe I won't, but you know, I'm in my 80s now. I got nothing to lose. Maybe God will be with me and I'll be able to take it. And now we read verse 20. He expelled from there the three sons of Anak. What I love about Caleb is that he didn't live in the past, did he? A lot of people live in the past. They're content to not move forward, but all they do is remember how good it used to be, and they'll recount all of the stuff they've done for the Lord. When I was 19, I remember I served the Lord, and I was doing this, and I was doing that. Great. We're glad for that heritage. Question, what are you doing right now? Caleb was one not to live in the past glories, but to see present challenges and welcome them. Didn't live in the past. We can stagnate very easily as believers. I think you know that's true, don't you? And you know what? We can stagnate also as Christian movements. Many Christian movements that have flourished stagnate because they look to the past and they exonerate the past and they build a monument to the past and educate their churches on the past great heroes of their great movement, and they're dead as a doornail because all they talk about is the past. Nobody goes forward. And I still hear this with the Jesus movement. Oh, don't you remember the Jesus movement? Remember the 60s, the 70s, man? Bell bottoms and tie-dye, and you know, we all stunk and had long hair and loved Jesus. Wasn't that great? Hey, big deal. Excuse me, Jesus is still moving today. It wasn't way back then where he moved and then he's moved on. I see Jesus moving all over the place. Let's not go back and exonerate some past movement. Use the past as a springboard, not as a sofa. Caleb didn't. What do you think they thought when they saw Caleb coming through Hebron? This guy just, you know, mean as he's in his 80s. He said, come on, where are those giants? They thought, oh no, he's back. You know, he's Jaws 2, Caleb 2. Just when you thought it was safe to go back into Canaan. Now, you're going to notice some changes in the rest of this chapter. There's some victories, partial settlements of territories, but more than anything else, there is a series of defeats. Now, you might be tempted to say, because it does say back in verse 19 that there were chariots of iron, so they were able to take the mountains but not the lowlands. And so you might look at this on a simply secular level, Bible as history level, and say, well, the reason the children of Israel did not advance through Canaan at that particular period of their history is they were outgunned. They didn't have chariots of iron like the Canaanites had, hence they were unable to take the land. I don't buy it. Because every time they took something, it says the Lord was with them and they took it. And didn't God promise just step foot in it and all figure out a way to take care of it? I mean, Jericho was a pretty good indication of that. They were outgunned there, but God took care of Jericho and subsequent cities. In fact, you'll notice something in the book of Judges. Children of Israel are always outnumbered. Gideon takes 300 guys only against, you know, a couple hundred thousand almost of the Midianites. Wipes them out. Deborah takes her standing army and fights against an army that has 900 iron chariots. Wipes them out. The key factor isn't are they outgunned, it's how much faith do they have in their God. It's back to the Joshua Caleb factor. How big is your God versus how big are the people? Verse 21. Starts getting bad now. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. And the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel, or Bethel, more accurate pronunciation. The name of the city was formerly Luz. When the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, "Please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy." So he showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but let the man and his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites, built a city, called its name Luz, which is named to this day. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shean and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages. Skip down to verse 28. It came to pass when Israel was strong that they put Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. Verse 29. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt at Gezer. Verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron. Verse 31, nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko. Verse 32, so the Asherites dwell among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. The last portion of the tribe of Asher that is described, it's significant. It's on the coast. And I wanted to bring the maps tonight in the computer to show you, but it just didn't quite work tonight, so we didn't do it. But picture the Mediterranean Sea. And up north in the area of Galilee in the Mediterranean Sea is this tribe of Asher. And they were like the buffer. So that when the Phoenicians were coming in and attacking the land, this would be the buffer. They'd drive them out. God said they would if they would believe him. But they just sort of, it seems like we're uninterested in driving them out. Let's not hassle them, man. We'll just live side by side peacefully. You say, well, that's a good strategy. I don't know. A few years later, somebody from this region, Canaanite, by the name of Jezebel, will marry one of the kings of the northern kingdom in Israel, Ahab, and plunge the entire country into idolatry, which will bring them Assyrian captivity. I say better to get the job done up front than go through that. But they didn't. That's the price of disobedience. It's high. Verse 33, nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Bet-Shemesh or the inhabitants of Bet-Anath. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down into the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres in Ajalon and in this other name. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim from Selah and upward. Now Dan settled in the south, but not for long. We get a hint of this back in the book of Joshua. They're in the Philistine country, which if you go on a tour to Israel today, they call the land of confrontation because most of the battles will be fought here. Philistine territory. That's why Samson has to get raised up and some of the other judges because the Philistines are constantly hassling them. So Dan gets tired of this and they ask for another tribal allotment. Eventually, because the Amorites, the Philistines, these Canaanite people hassle the tribe of Dan, they have a huge, beautiful territory down south. They migrate north to a place called Laish. And if you go on a tour to Israel, we take you to a place known as Tel Dan, or the nature reserve at Dan, where the tribe of Dan settled in the north and because they couldn't drive out their enemies down south. That's the chapter. And it's a sad beginning. And we'll see the children of Israel go through this cycle. We'll see God deliver them. But Joshua fully expected the tribes to take initiative. It was a go-for-it attitude. It wasn't sit around and wait and see what God will do. On this one, it was just walk, man. And wherever you walk, it's yours. Joshua chapter 1. Every place the sole of your foot walks, I have given to you. Isn't that a great promise? It's just like, you make a step. What about this step? Yeah, I've already given it to you. Okay, what about that one? Yeah, already done. Every place you walk, it's already yours. Here's the kicker. From the promise that God gave to these guys back in Deuteronomy, if you take the measurements, the river of Egypt, all the way up to Syrian borders and beyond to Mesopotamia, you find out that God originally promised the children of Israel a portion of land that totals around 300,000 square miles. It's a big chunk. It includes modern-day Jordan, includes parts of Iraq, Syria. Of course, the people in those areas today wouldn't be excited about those border arrangements, but that was the original deal. Israel, at its peak under David and Solomon, only occupied 30,000 square miles, a ratio of a tenth. This is what God has given. They only took a tenth. Can you relate to that? Ephesians 1 says, God has given us every spiritual blessing in Christ Jesus in heavenly places. Oh, Lord, that's nice, but I just want this little tenth. Yeah, but get a big vision. I'll bless you with more. And I'm not just obviously speaking financially here. You shouldn't take it out of context. But just what God can do through a life, the spiritual riches and inheritance in Christ. And yet so many believers, I'll just stay right here and I'll just settle for this. And we'll see that the blessing that God has was forfeited by the children of Israel. And then God had pity on them and restored them back and gave them another chance. Okay, take the land, but they didn't do it. But each time God's hand is outstretched saying, I'll restore, I'll take you back.